This is a brief talk, so there will be very little introduction, but of course I have to tell you what this is. This is the vicinity of KITP, and you'll see what it has to do with migration in the next slide. I'll be talking about trying to answer a couple of questions about co-rotational and versus Lindblad resonances in this planet interaction. Slow migration, fast migration, is there type 1 and type 2 migration, and what stops type 3 motion, where, and so on. Type 1 migration and type 2 migration, for those who don't know what these things are embedded migration, you know, when you're under the surface, and this is a gray whale that Manhoy took a snapshot of. The credit goes to him. Type 2 is much more in the open, you know. The planet emerges from the disk, is no longer so embedded and hidden in it. And by the way, yeah, there will be a trip on Wednesday. There are some seats for whale watching from the airplane. Okay, but that's beside the point. You know, the standard problem with type 1, type 2, that the rates are pretty fast. People always worry while they look at this plot from Bill Ward's work. And I must say that Bill had some crummy reproduction of one of my figures in his PP4 book. And this is my revenge. Okay. Sorry, Bill. This is mass in the Earth, one Earth, 10 Earths, 100 Earths, and on Jupiter somewhere here. And type 1 is this linearly growing speed of migration and shorter time scales along this axis. Peaks at 10 to the 4th years for these parameters. And then we are supposed to go into gap opening and type 2, which is much slower usually. For reasonable choices of alpha, which agree with the types of T-Tauri disk viscosities which are observed, if you read Lee Hartman's review in PP4 or anybody else's, they are somewhere here. So type 2 is supposedly much slower. And it is in a gap, planet is centered in a gap, the disk is more massive than the planet. So it keeps the planet in the gap and directs it to go this or that way at the viscous speed. But there is, there are other types of migration which I will not discuss, like caused by gas drag and radiation pressure for small bodies. They also may be extremely rapid, like here. And there are also types of migration which use n-body gravity between the bodies to move bodies. But those usually don't have a chance to move the bodies long way. And the great migrations, like of the whales, that's what we're interested in here in this talk. Co-rotational flows, if properly included, can cause your planets to move on timescales which are very short. And we'll just see how short. Okay. If I plot these timescales, type 3 is way above. The difference is that the physics of interaction is a little different because in type 1 and type 2, planets are repelled from disks, really. While in type 3, the planet is really sucked into the disk and attracted to the dense part of the disk. That will cause also some differences in the outcome of migration, because the typical disk won't try to get rid of the planet and drop it onto the star if it has some structure. It will keep the planet in the dense disk parts. All right, that's not so important. This is the essential physics of what's happening around the planet and why it migrates. This is just a section of a disk from 0.7 to 1.3 times the same major axis of a planet. in the frame rotating with the planet, the inner part of the disk goes this way, the outer part of the disk goes that way, and we usually have some clearing or a gap, not always a full gap and so on, but we call this co-rotational region because gas elements can make a U-turn, stay in this region. Sometimes they manage to make another U-turn and stay there more or less forever or for a long time. The co-rotational flow is the flow of the region at the edge of the gap, sort of, here in this picture. There will be a separatrix dividing this flow into two parts, one which does a U-turn and one which goes back into the disk. And most of the action, really, between the planet and the disk is connected with these edges, which are somewhat outside and somewhat inside the separatrix. That's where most of the torques originate. But there is also a lot of interesting reasons to have torques in the vicinity within the Roche law. Let's just watch one example of outward migration. In this case, I have the disk represented in as azimuth and radius, not as x and y coordinates, and my planet is at somewhere along the azimuth, but at radius 1. This is radius 2, 3, and 4. I use
What's the color?
This is surface density. So the disk has a structure. It has a very low density region here. The surface density grows. There's a maximum. And then it decays somewhat, not very fast, outward. OK? Oh, that was too far. How do you go back? Yeah. Let's see if it's. And yet it moves. Okay. And yet it moves. The time in the orbital periods is really scary. It's short. The planet essentially creates around itself a very interesting density structure which supports that migration. And it migrates out, as you see. It climbed up the steep density gradient initially, but then it continued going out on a reverse gradient. Then, of course, it hit the outer boundary of my computation. It lost this structure, which supports migration. And then it hesitated for a while and will probably get locked here. And might actually, in some simulations, planets tend to stay out at the whatever outer radius of the disk you create for them. Or they may go in slowly. They are really mobile, and the direction is not predetermined by the disk structure alone. That's the basic conclusion, basic point for this type of migration.
How much mass was lost out of the box during this run?
Nothing.
Oh, it's only redistributed.
Yeah, right. The outer boundary condition is forces a convergence to a Keplerian flow, but there, no mass is lost from the disk. It also, I should mention, planet also does not accrete any gas because of the short time scales. That would be quite inappropriate to let it actually grow by much.
So just based on the color code, I would assume that mass has disappeared, but you say it's not the case?
No. From where, you mean? Right. Well, that's a good question. Actually, I left all these interesting numerical things for the discussion because I knew it will generate some discussion. But I can tell you, I don't have a blow up right now in this talk. I have it, some of it maybe later. These type of codes can be made to have very high resolution around the planet. This one is a variable resolution adaptive grid in the sense that the fine part of the grid moves together with the planet, but it's not a multi-grid. It would correspond to a multi-grid with the three levels or four levels. It's not a highly. But we have a variety of codes. It's a very, very essential point. I'll bring up in maybe during the discussion. that you have to compare different codes. If you have just one code, there may be some numerical funny effects, and there are some differences between the codes, definitely. But the resolution here is, let's say, 0.5% of same major axis, or 10 times larger than the Roche lobe in this particular simulation. But that's not the best we can do by far. We can resolve down to the size of the planet with AMR codes, like flash. And we do that, but I don't want to concentrate on that, on numerics. Let's do some theory. Very important parameter is the zeta. Zeta is the ratio between the Roche lobe and the co-rotational region half-width, or the separatrix distance. Zeta is of order of more or less between 2 and 3, as people know from numerics. But it's a very important thing that we need to pay attention because that determines the ratio of co-rotational torques to Lindblad torques. If you send a parcel of gas along these trajectories I was showing, it experiences an outward push, which is the reason for shepherding, down to the separatrix, and then it experiences a big jump onto the other side, which is like which is a delta L angular momentum jump proportional to the initial distance of this orbit. This figure is not to scale, I must warn you, because co-rotations actually win, as you will see on the next slide. The next slide tells you how to do this integration, which is the simple calculation to do, and you get a co-rotational torque which scales as the third power of co-rotational radius. Just because the jump in angular momentum is one power of x, flux of matter is another power of x, and if you integrate x squared, you get x to the third. So that's the reason for the co-rotational torque formula, and there are of course coefficients there. The Lindblad torque formula has a different sign because this, we are considering one-sided disk for a moment, just the outer disk. Okay, the co-rotational torque has a minus sign, and that's a sign of the torque on the material in the disk, while there is a positive and relatively smaller angular momentum pumping into the disk. It's proportional to mass of the planet squared, like every tidal interaction. Sigma in the disk and minus third power of the co-rotational radius, if you use the impulse approximation, for instance. So if you rewrite this mu as 3 times Roche lobe to the third, these things are modified such that you actually get, this is actually the sixth power of co-rotational radius, so you get the same factor as here and the same sigma as here, but there is this number of order 2.5, which makes all the difference because there is a sixth power of it here. And co-rotations win in that situation by order of magnitude. As is known from free particle calculations in a cold disk and some other considerations. So now there are these different levels of description that we really want to use because they have their own advantages. There's this symmetric switch model that I just described, that a particle comes and does a symmetric switch from plus x to minus x because of the co-rotational interaction. It describes the kinematics and timing of these librating motions pretty well. But of course, it doesn't determine the co-rotational region size. Then there are somewhat more clever approximations that we are doing, guiding center approximation in Hill's equations or in restricted free body. If you eliminate rapid eccentric motion and just try to follow the guiding centers of the slightly eccentric orbit, you can actually get pretty far, and you actually obtain realistic co-rotational sides, but you still don't know the full density distribution, for which you'll need numerical hydrodynamics, which also gives the same. However, numerical dynamics has its own difficulties, and I would like to leave this for the discussion, as I said. So let me show you a simulation now of the flow lines of these regularized orbits, or you might say guiding center orbits, around a planet with the Roche lobe, which is this size, and there it's not a square box, so that's why Roche lobe looks a little bit funny. And here, as a function of migration rate, because I should say that these kind of theories allow very easily the inclusion of migration of a planet into the whole story. Let's try to do this again. From the usual horseshoe type orbits, as you crank up the migration rate of the planet, the orbits deform. There is a point which is equivalent of Lagrange point L4, which moves closer to the planet as the migration rate increases, and the librating region shrinks in size. But still, the material switches from inside to outside according to the Roche lobe size and the XCR. Sorry?
Can you explain again what is going into that calculation?
Right. That was a theory in which you take equations, split the motion into sort of fast motion, epicyclic motion, and the more gradual motion of the guiding center. The guiding center, as it approaches the planet, may be switched not very rapidly over many orbital periods from one side to another. And these are the orbits that I'm showing. I'm neglecting the epicycles on top of them. That's why you don't see the wakes. I eliminate the wakes because I know they're not going to play a major role in the story. So the type of geometry that you get is the following. From the symmetric situation for A.0, you go to the slow migration case where libration takes place over the whole range of azimuths, so you get a horseshoe which is, however, asymmetric. Because of this relative flow of the disk material, which brings it toward the planet and makes all these lines which were initially like that inclined, you get a narrower horseshoe part in front of the planet than in the back of the planet in case of positive A dot. I'm drawing the figures for positive A dot. But there is also another regime of fast migration where situation changes because that librating region has shrunk and there is no more librating material reaching the planet at all from the front. And that's the case where you actually get the maximum torque and you cannot get really much more. So, as you saw in the simulations, there is really this underdense region here and the overdense region in front of the planet, and that is the engine of the type 3 migration. And type 3 migration runs on vacuum. It's very cheap, actually. See, this is the reason for type 3 migration. To confirm this and to track the where material is going rather than the density, because that's perturbed by density waves, you look at potential vorticity. And potential vorticity looks even much closer where the material, which is captured from the low density part of the disk here, is carried with the planet. It's like a balloon with the hot underdense air which carries this planet. And at the end, you'll see it's lost. But not the mass, not the total mass. Total mass doesn't disappear. It just flows into the disk. And you no longer have this underdense region, and you have to stop the fast migration. All right, so what is the migration formula? Many people would like to know what is the speed of that migration. And there's a simple theory for that, which incorporate, sort of joins the slow and fast migration regime in one formula, because you can just calculate from kinematics how wide this extent is, the x2 versus xcr, depending on the migration rate of a planet. There is a characteristic speed, which I call a dot fast, given by that formula, at which you go from slow to fast migration. And this x2 has a nonlinear behavior on speed, scaled to that characteristic speed. When you compute the angular momentum flux in the usual way, as always, you get coefficient proportional to surface density, as you see here. It's just a non-dimensional surface density, pi r squared sigma, a difference between the front side and the back side of the planet. Xcr to the third, just like in the previous estimates, that rotational torques have to scale like that. But there is now this modifying factor, which depends on the speed. And it's nonlinear. Initially, it is linear, but then it's nonlinear, and then it saturates. If you equate that rotational torque with assumed A dot to the torque needed to sustain that particular A dot, which is simple formula that you all know, you get the answer for your A dot, because it's on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side of the equation. So let's look at the solution. Solution looks like this. Let's initially ignore all Lindblad resonances and just have co-rotational torques. This parameter quantifies the disk mass to planet mass ratio, or more precisely, mass, characteristic mass of the disk just around the planet within the co-rotational region width, minus the mass in the gap. Because remember, there's this difference of sigmas in front and back of the planet, which is like sigma in the disk and sigma in the librating region. And that's the most important parameter. If this parameter is less than 1, then in that simple problem, nothing happens. The planet stays fixed, because there are no other torques that I assume. However, if you cross the characteristic disk mass or disk mass deficit, if it becomes larger than the mass of the planet, which, by the way, is the basic assumption of standard type 2 migration, something very interesting happens. There is a solution for velocity which says 0, but it's unstable. And you depart from it in a runaway way. That's what some of you may have read, the paper by Frederic Massé and John Papaloisi, who co-discovered the type 3 a couple of years ago. They described this whole migration as runaway migration. It's even in the title. Well, that's actually not so. A better analysis shows that it's only the departure from the unstable slow migration, which is sort of runaway process. But you reach a point here where migration is very steady. All your numerical work will show that migration proceeds at a pretty constant rate until the disk parameters change, because it gets far or near to the star very rapidly. Okay? So in a place where you should have type 2, there is type 3 instead. Formula, here's your formula. A dot on that branch is 1.66, that front coefficient, times this delta Q, which is the difference, non-dimensional mass deficit, times Keplerian speed. And it's for a Jupiter, that formula says that you migrate, it should double or half the distance in 44 periods. For the Polish speakers, I should say that one of our national poets said this number, 40 and 4. It's one of the major riddles of why he said the number 44 in his very important work. I think this was the Jupiter's migration timescale. Okay, in type 3. Now, what happens if I add back all these things that you all like so much? Lindblad torques, differential Lindblad torque, right? That causes the type 1 or other things like type 2, slow drift of the disk material. Well, something happens, of course. I add the Lindblad differential torque, for which I use the notation A dot 1, although it's not necessarily the type 1 migration. Masses of the planets may be much larger here. But it's the essentially migration due to differential Lindblad torque. That's why I use this subscript 1. Type 2 is the viscous speed, actually. The situation doesn't change a lot. It changes qualitatively in an interesting way that you just give a bias to the planet to go in the direction of a differential Lindblad torque, which is, let's say, negative and small here. This is just a pedagogical example when it's constant, independent of these ratios. So you give it a bias. For slow migration, you get back your differential Lindblad migration. For large migration, the only thing you do, you algebraically add the speed if differential torque goes in the same way, or you have to subtract it from the type 3 migration. But type 3 is always much faster. And there is the unstable branch, which is of no particular interest. This just shows you that as you, for instance, increase the disk mass, let's say, or something like that, or maybe decrease the increase the mass of the planet or something, which makes this parameter go this way, you have a smooth transition between type 3 and other types originally imagined. But if you go against the differential Lindblad torque, like in some of my calculations, where a planet goes out, it doesn't really want to do it of itself. And if it slows down, it will have a very abrupt change of behavior. And that's why these planets, when they get to the edge of the disk or low density region, which brings them here to this point, they make an abrupt stop, very abrupt stop. And they can start going back maybe at a different rate. Okay, so I described all this. I would like to finish by considering the actual planetary systems and planets. What does it apply to? And should we worry about this? Well, of course, timescales are very short, and everything is a bit different, so we should worry about this. But should any of those who study the resonant planet systems should worry about this, for instance? Well, yes and no. I think that this mostly applies to the disk, which is still high mass. Okay, you saw that you need a certain mass of order of planet mass to do these kind of things. But that may not last for the whole lifetime of a disk. Perhaps you do transition to the more usual types of migrations, like modified type 1, because you need to really take into account these rotational effects. Or even maybe type 2 in some cases. But for that, you need a disk mass which is typically less than the planet mass. And that's not the standard type 2. It's a type 2b, which Ed Toms and Jack Lissauer described in one of their recent reviews of migration as type 3. But I would like to beg them to reserve that name for a completely different physical processes. Type 2b is the case where the planet is now so massive, it's more massive than the surrounding disk, that this actually slows down its migration below type 2 speed by a factor, which is the disk mass to the planet mass. So that's still possible, but that's in the late stage of the evolution of the nebula, when it's already starting to go, probably. Where does this type 3 stop? Actually, it's easy to start it if you have any gradient in a disk, but it's easy to stop it too.
According to Frederick, there is another case where type 2 should still dominate. It's the case with low viscosity, where the gap is significantly larger than the completion.
Right. If you are able to clean the gap out to something like reasonably larger than the co-rotational region, then you would go back to the standard type 2. However, it's extremely difficult to do. It's extremely difficult to do. It's a theoretical concept, but I don't know how academic that is. Because we do numerical calculations after all, and in those calculations which you saw, there is no viscosity added. So the numerical viscosity is rather low. These are high order schemes, PPM or different implementations of PPM. They are not dissipative like Zeus or any low order codes. So they do have low viscosities and they don't have these huge gaps, which are required to completely eliminate the material from the vicinity of co-rotational region and stop the flow through the gap. So where does the migration stop? Well, whenever you have these edges, you might start migration if your planet gets suddenly big, it crosses the, 10 Earth mass and gets a lot of gas, and then it starts migrating up the hill. But then it will definitely stop if there is an outer radius at which the, let's say, dead zone ends. Or it may start here and go back here and get lodged here. That depends on the mass accretion rate of the planet, where its mass grows sufficiently so it gets stabilized. And we also have some calculations in which, without adding any mass, the planet stabilizes at some place where the torques get into equilibrium. But that all happens in disks which have structure. You cannot have your power law disk, which is more massive than the planet, like in a standard type 2, let's say, situation, and because then you would lose the planet onto the star in no time at all. Another situation is, of course, this inner magnetospheric gap. But I think it's very fruitful at this stage to start thinking about all the reasons that the Tetauri disks might have a radial structure, which is different from power law, because power law is really deadly. If you have structure, you can stop type 3. You can probably grow in mass and stay there. And I'll leave that for the discussion. There's also this question of what the type 3 does to other smaller planets around. The big planet can be saved by the disk structure, but what about the Earths in the terrestrial zone region? If there is a giant planet doing these rather fast and rather violent motions, well, if you ask me about this, I'll show you some simulations of what happens then. But with Richard Edgar, who is here, we think that this is actually the only type of migration which will save the terrestrial planets. All the others will bulldoze, capture small planets and embryos into mean motion resonances and might push them onto the sun. But this type actually doesn't. The giant planet travels so fast that there's still ample time to damp any resulting eccentricities. There's no resonant capture. So let me see if I... Okay. The summary is this. There's a new type of migration. Depends on co-rotations being much stronger than Lindblads, but it's a natural situation if disks are more massive than planets. Direction is now more than just a function of disk properties. Depends on prior history. There is more variety, more diversity, if you like, for your exoplanetary systems possible. Planets can travel out, and they can go out to God knows how far. Depends on the disk structure and density. They can get really far. There is no essential problem of having planets now at large radii. Preliminary results show that type 3 is actually something like type 3, may also apply to type 1 situation. That is, that there's no type 1 and there's only type 3. But I wouldn't make that strong a statement at this point, but I can tell you why I think so and why. What is the evidence. Now, I discussed the sensitivity to the structure, how to stop it, that it doesn't cause the demise of terrestrial planet regions. And I'd like to finish with thanking the organizers for this beautifully organized, sometimes disorganized, but that's okay, meeting. It's been very, very productive period, and I'd like to thank them.
Thanks a lot. Okay, the floor is open to questions or comments. Stan?
Paul, it wasn't clear to me what the conditions were that would lead to the planet going outwards versus inwards with the type 3 migration. What were the disk conditions or structure that would lead to out or in?
Right. Let's see if I can... get some of these previous graphs. The conditions are to have type 3 migration at all are to have sufficient mass, as I said. But then direction will be determined by the initial gradient. If you place your planet on a positive gradient, like at the inner edge of the dead zone, it will start migrating out. It will capture the underdense region and it will go out until something happens to the structure of the disk. If you do the same on the outer edge of something, the planet will go in, and then there are two cases. One is that it will find the inner edge of that enhanced density region, and then it will stop by losing the bubble lodging and so on. The other possibility is that there is a natural tendency for this mass of the disk as compared to the mass of the planet to go down as you approach the star. There's less and less gas available really around the star than at the larger radii. So it's actually quite easy to have this migration stop at the intermediate range of 1 AU or 1/2 AU or whatever you want, just by the fact that there is now much less gas than the planet itself already has. And that's another reason that you can have migration stopped, right?
So as I understand it correctly, the thing moves toward the region of higher disk density.
Essentially, that's the simple statement, right.
In a type 2 situation, the density would build up on the outside of the planet versus inside, and then you'd have a natural thing to go out.
And that's why I can show you, well, this is the question period, so if you ask me, can you show me the case, numerical case, numerical case when you start with something like type 2 and it itself transitions to type 3, I'll show it to you, but you have to ask the question.
Okay.
I have it here in the computer.
Show us. Show us.
All right. Thank you for asking that question. Let's see, which one? I don't want to cheat you. Now I better go back to this view. So yeah, both Flash code and my PPM implementation, which are completely different actually. One is Eulerian, one is Lagrangian. It's very important to compare different codes. Well, that's one example. I'll show you the results of Flash, and that will be just two colors. This is not surface density, just two colors. The co-rotational region, more or less, at the initial stage is colored red and the rest is colored blue. We'll see how matter mixes in the course of the Flash simulation. This one is a 5 multi-level, okay, adaptive mesh, 5 levels, resolution God knows how high, 10 to minus 3 of the radius, whatever you want. Yes, this is Invisid. And initially nothing happens. That's your kind of type 2, right? But that's caused predominantly by the specific surface density, which didn't have any strong differential co-rotational torques, because there's roughly equal amount of stuff outside and inside the planet. But as the computation progresses, you start getting a big asymmetry, backward, forward asymmetry in the librating region, as you see, and you transition to type 3, because this is a well-developed, fast type 3 migration that you see now. And I have similar things with other codes. This is, I think, that was a 1 Jupiter mass, I think. Yeah. And, yeah. And the disk, usually we have to use disks which are a few times more massive than the minimum solar nebula, right? Because what minimum solar nebula is around that parameter range when the switch from slow migration to fast migration occurs. If you really, really need slow migration, you place your bets on a sub-minimum solar nebula.
How many orbits did you run for that energy?
I think 50 or 70, something like this. And then it goes into this mode when the transition time is just 20 orbits.
What is different about your code that leads to this transition from type 2 to type 3 that hasn't been seen by other codes like Linus?
Yes, right.
People?
Well, oh no, this is just a. Well, differences are probably. I don't know if they're deciding, but first of all, we have codes which are where we treat the gravity around the planet rather carefully. We, for instance, we tend to avoid large softening radii, which are normally used, sometimes of order Rochelle. We avoid artificially excluding torques from the Rochelle region on the planet, because if you do that, that can change your result. We know that. It does, actually. So we found that you actually need plenty of resolution. You have to have the grid resolution much better than the softening resolution for your gravity. You can't have them equal, for instance, or else your results will strongly depend on these parameters. The other reason is that we tend to use massive disks. By massive, I don't mean really gravitationally unstable or anything like that, but I have the impression that many researchers want to get slow migration and they use low disk masses. We can talk about this and ask if they do. What else? Other than this, I think the codes are pretty similar. They are actually except that some codes that we don't use are very dissipated, like Zeus, and we don't like that. But
is there a problem with your variable grid size in such things as conservations of angular momentum and so forth?
No.
Are there any numerical?
No. Actually, that's why you compare very different implementations, both of the algorithm, one of which is Lagrangian, the other Eulerian, and also types of grids. We have XY grids, completely square grids. We also have these results were shown. These were R-phi grids, obviously. And we have also adaptive meshes, which define their resolution as they go. And essentially, you get type 3. You know, if you start with the different conditions as well, if you preset the conditions to give you something that will lock you into a slow migration, maybe that's possible as well. The example is that I was talking to Gennaro D'Angelo, and he was complaining that he doesn't get these type 3 migrations, right? So with Steve Lubo, and Gennaro is working now with Steve Lubo, well, we set out to explore the same initial conditions precisely, you know, as precisely as we could. And just 2 weeks ago, he got type 3 migration. He joined the club. I invite all the others.
What did he change?
Nothing. The initial surface density. Yeah. Not in my calculation, because I consider these timescales to be too short to allow actual. I'm afraid to switch on. If I do, because I do have calculations, of course, with that, that modifies the migration rate, but not the very basic fact that you can still have type 3. It's just that in these simple-minded theories like mine, you would cut down the coefficient torque by a factor of 2, because your mass is now doing one half of the flyby, and it ends up on a planet, and there are.
On a larger planet, also the temperature. So, defining the ability to push yourself beyond the
Oh, you mean the transition into this very large mass regime where it just gets lodged by inertia, like you considered before. That's possible. That's actually the one of the key issues that we don't know right now. The numericists don't know how much M dot to allow onto their planets, and the theorists cannot provide them with a clear answer. Whether the planet, whether a growing Jupiter doubles its mass in something like hundreds of orbits or millions of orbits. It's actually bad, and we would like to know. Then I should mention that all these issues of A dot, E dot, and M dot are connected. So we are actually trying to simplify and find the, give you the simple description, but in fact, they are all connected.
What about our eccentricity?
Eccentricity is strongly damped, like you've heard already. Also, at high resolution that we run, it's always strongly damped, and we ascribe it to co-orbital Lindblad resonances.
Question.
Jack has a
question.
Comment on nomenclature and what the how it relates to the physics, and then I have a question of mechanisms. The reason that Ed and I chose to name the mass ratio limiting effect as type 3 is planets would transition from type 1 to type 2 to type 3, and that would change their rate. And this is somewhat of a different thing. So right, what we call type 3 is physically more similar to type 2, and if you want to categorize them in the way of just different groups and with the nomenclature related to when they were first thought of, that would be type 1, type 2, type 3, according to yours. But if you want to name them in physical progression of where they might go, yours is this co-rotation induced is somewhat of a different one out of the scheme and would come in at different times. And the physical question I have is the relationship between this, which is a gas-induced co-rotational local scattering type calculation, and the planetesimal induced rapid migration to explain these hot inner planets, giant Vulcans, hot Jupiters, Majorettes, whatever you want to call them, the model by Norm and Scott, and who's your third author, Norm?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the mechanisms are a little bit different because in the planetesimal migration caused by planetesimal disk, we have resonant interactions which actually transfer the can shoot out the planetesimals from one side to another. You need to transfer from inside to outside to be able to migrate in, and that's the mechanism. However, it doesn't happen in this co-rotational region as defined here, so it's a different place where you do the actual interaction, and also just a naturally much higher masses of gas disks suggest that this may be more commonly encountered in the planetary exoplanetary systems, because you need really a very high mass of planetesimal disks, and then imagine how much gas, imagine the frog.
Yes, I have another question concerning a remark you made. I mean, you mentioned this torque cutoff radius that you take something, you go deep into the Rossloop and include that material into the torque calculation there.
This gravitational softening, probably. Cutoff, you mean the
cutoff for the torque calculation?
Out,
yes.
Ignoring the torque near the planet.
And you mentioned that this is very important. I mean, isn't it that the material which is deep inside the Rossloop is gravitationally bound to the planet and cannot torque on the planet itself? So there must be, I mean, at some certain level, there must be a cutoff where you don't exclude material because it belongs to the planet, and the planet can't pull itself through the disk, I guess. So there must be some cutoff. And how much do these results, your results, depend on these quantities? I mean, you have very high resolution simulations, so it must be possible, or maybe it's possible, that you can infer this, where you get this transition, or what is important here.
Right, I think that maybe something like what you're suggesting. It's never good to actually cut one half of the interaction. Interaction is always two ways, so it's not really okay to cut the forces exerted by one component on the other and not the other way around. So I would suggest that this is not a very good idea, but if you want, you could do something like define a small region, really small region around the planet as the planet itself. You cannot do this in the outer part of the Roche lobe, though, because here you see the flow is actually entering the Roche lobe, hitting the outer Bowshock-like structure, and leaving the Roche lobe. This is not the part of the planet yet. So if you do that at all, do it in a small, very small fraction of Roche lobe.
Other questions? Very back.
Two questions. One on the flash. Have you checked its angular momentum conservation?
Yes, of course. You mean by doing this calculation, whether the disk is, let's say, you know, spreading the rings artificially or something like this? Yes, of course.
Second question would be, you show the potential vorticity movie. It went very fast. I didn't see it. It seems it's maintained a constant around the planet. There should be shocks associated with the planet as it moves around.
Do you mean this surface density or potential vorticity?
I think so. You showed a potential vorticity movie.
Right.
Can you show that again?
Yeah. I'll show it because I don't know. Let's see which effect you mean. Somewhere here. This must have been this. Yeah. Okay. So that's the calculation. Which effect do you? There's vorticity generation. That's probably what you're interested in. And you can see vortices generated by the planet as it goes. A lot of these small structures are vortices. Oh, shocks are not so easily visible, actually. You see some of the shocks, but you mostly see the where the original mass captured from the edge of the disk goes. Shock is here. Do you see it? No, because it's actually the conditions on this part of the shock are such that it's a weak shock that does not produce a lot of it. The only place where it produces some vorticity is close to the planet. It's within the co-rotational region, not outside. So you actually, by looking at this, you just eliminate the Lindblad resonances. You eliminate the waves, and you just look at the co-rotation.
You're saying the shock?
Yeah, shock is going like this in the outer disk. It's not seen here.
Is there a hand over here that I have? There are two hands.
Two.
There's 3 minutes left.
Okay. I sort of thought of this as somewhat like a finite amplitude instability, where you sort of had to initially give it a shove or give it a gradient so it'll pick up a shove, this sort of thing. And that's sort of the way I understood it. But when you showed this transition from type 2 to type 3, I'm curious about this one. For instance, it seems
is this mass deficit. If you open a gap, you will find a point for a big enough planet.
Well, my question is, is this because would this tendency, which we saw this asymmetry begin to develop, and then eventually it took off? How would that be affected if you increase the viscosity of the disk? Would that tend to suppress that, smooth that out, so it's not so easy to access that? I mean, you were saying you're using very small
viscosity.
Probably
not, because you can't have sufficiently high viscosity in these disks to close a gap around Jupiter. That's the answer. Jupiter will open a gap no matter what. It actually, there is a slight effect that if you have the viscous drift that it enhances cohortation in that situation because it just feeds more material through the gap, and that's what you rely on. You don't rely merely on the motion of the planet itself. There's in addition some supply by viscosity. So if anything, it might even enhance it somewhat. But by how much? Viscous speeds are so low.
Well, again, I can see that once it's going, but to start from a well-defined gap where it's stable or appears to be stable for a long period of time, and then this develops, I wonder whether a higher viscosity would prevent that sort of asymmetry, the azimuthal asymmetry, from getting large enough to actually break down the confining torques. I just wonder whether you had an opinion about that.
My feeling is that it does not, actually. But now,
what was the viscosity that you were
deep
using?
Deep gap, the conditions aren't stable, let's face it.
Okay, little hand's almost on the eight. Doug wants to have the last word.
Can you go back to figure seven, panel seven, and where you...
Is that before or after?
It's the one with the figure, with the, you know, those arrows.
Okay.
Right.
Where are the arrows? Oh, one to four.
Well,
no, it will be here once my
that's
computer.
It. Now, if I look at this, you know, just very close to the planet, let's go back to the Willy's point.
Uh-huh.
You see the two enhancements, one on each side of the planet. Now, is that where most of the torque is coming from? Is that, by and large, what causes things to go one way or the other? Is that symmetry that is causing things?
You can look at...
You showed it by this distorted Roche lobe, but, you know, most of the material from the distorted Roche lobe is quite further away, quite far away. But this is the region where you get the intensity and you get all of the action. Is that where most of the cause of this migration is?
Well, technically, it's true that the you'll get order of unity differences depending on the treatment of that region, and that they are important. But look at the torques in the other way, which is the flux of angular momentum. Think about this. There is no accretion onto the planet in this problem. This whole material inside the separatrix has to go in and has to go out. And no matter what, it does get the well-defined jump in angular momentum, independent of details, actually. So you can look at this two ways. One is to just look at density and calculate the torque from density, but that's missing the point that this density is always adjusted in such a way as to provide you with the given separatrix distance.
The reason I said that
then
is
you can
that it,
neglect these details.
Is that it's actually the asymmetry of the two halves that makes this difference. And if you had some large-scale turbulence or slight eccentricity to this planet, wouldn't you destroy that asymmetry, and especially close to those regions?
Actually, during migration, well, they are even more asymmetric. This is like the beginning of migration. Things get very asymmetric here on two sides, and front and back. If you have some eccentricity, this, let's say, smaller than the extent of this Roche lobe, then nothing very dramatic happens. I don't know, for larger eccentricities, they decay very quickly, so we don't happen to see this in the numerical calculations. So small wobbles don't change the picture, actually, because all this region travels very precisely together with the planet. Vortices, probably, you're concerned with whether small vortices, which are generated on the edge of the gap, if they get close, if they get in and out of the Roche lobe, can they perturb significantly? I think they can, but only small planets. We have to study this. This is a very important thing for small planets. For large planets, we just don't see the noise. You know, we see vortices, but we don't see noise on migration caused by them.
Okay, I think that's a good point to stop. Let's thank Pavel very much again, and we'll break until 4:10.